Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
It's back to the classroom for Florida school kids.
I hope it's a peaceful one, and I hope the worst thing that happens on a campus is that somebody gets a C on a test.
Also this week, do you know the background of your child's substitute teachers? It turns out the state of Florida doesn't know either.
First issue is, how can we form a database of everyone who comes in contact with our children, and if they have been released from any district?
We'll also get the latest on Hurricane Michael recovery efforts throughout Northwest Florida, and we'll try to figure out what state wildlife officials meant when they advised residents to euthanize those pesky iguanas, but to do so in a humane fashion. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. As students across the state prepare to head back to school, ensuring their safety in the classroom is top of mind for teachers, administrators, law enforcement, and state leaders. Regan McCarthy has more.
In Leon County, school officials are putting new active shooter practices into play. Superintendent Rocky Hanna told the Florida Channel the school has armed officers on payroll. But the district is not implementing the controversial option of arming teachers, a part of the so-called Guardian program.
We have armed safety officers in all of our schools that are sworn law officers. We are not implementing the Guardian program, which has been very controversial. We're not arming school staff. We're not arming teachers. But we have committed about $850,000 and hired 50 security monitors that are unarmed but work side by side with those law enforcement officers to monitor the campuses.
During a practice Wednesday, Leon County administrators were given real-world scenarios and taken through procedures to prepare them for an actual emergency. Director Damon Kelly with the Department of Education's Office of Safe Schools says that kind of emergency planning is an excellent example for the rest of the state.
For me, to come to an exercise like this right before school starts is a breath of fresh air, because it shows me that the Leon County School District are preparing for the school year that lies ahead. I hope it's a peaceful one, and I hope the worst thing that happens on a campus is that somebody gets a C on a test.
After the school shooting in Parkland, lawmakers passed new school safety legislation aimed at better protecting students and hardening school campuses. Some of those changes include a provision that made it easier for law enforcement to arrest and prosecute students who make threats of violence at school. It's something State Attorney Jack Campbell says is important. He says one shooting can often lead to copycat crime.
Often people don't realize the consequences of their behavior. Often people don't recognize, particularly young people, that on a social media forum that they're able to strike fear.
Since the Parkland school shooting, lawmakers have also expanded background checks and now require a person to be at least 21 to purchase a firearm. But after the most recent mass shootings in Texas and Ohio, Florida Senate President Bill Galvano says more needs to be done. He's charging Brandon Republican Senator Tom Lee with leading a review of mass and school shootings and looking for underlying causes, including white nationalism and mental illness. Lawmakers will start that process when they return to Tallahassee for committee meetings next month. Meanwhile, the state is being held up as a model for passing the so-called red flag law following the Parkland school shooting. It's aimed at keeping guns out of the wrong hands by allowing law enforcement to temporarily keep people from having guns. President Donald Trump has called on states across the country to follow suit. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Right now, the State Department of Education in Florida does not keep a complete database of all substitute teachers in the state. But Ryan Daly reports one violent tragedy in Tallahassee last year has raised concerns and a push for better record keeping at the state level.
After news surfaced that Scott Beerly, the man who shot and killed two people, injuring several others in Tallahassee Hot Yoga Studio in November, had been a substitute teacher in several counties, local leaders in education became concerned.
That was my yoga studio. I attend class there and have for years, and so I've been in that class. I know the instructor. I know what that room is like.
That's Leon County School Board member Alva Striplin, who began asking questions about the guidelines surrounding hiring and record keeping on substitutes shortly after the shooting. Beerly was a substitute in Leon between 2015 and 16 and was fired as a substitute by Leon County after he accessed pornography sites on campus. He was later fired by the Volusia County School District for inappropriately touching a student.
It hit really, really close to home. And of course, then as information started surfacing about the shooter, we got word that he had been in our school district. And I was just... it was just so disturbing. I mean, everything about it was disturbing, obviously. But then to find out that he had been around our children, this could have easily been one of our schools.
The State Department of Education currently keeps no statewide database on substitute teachers working in Florida's 67 counties. Striplin was surprised to hear that when she inquired about a master list.
So when I started making some phone calls to the Florida School Board Association and said, hey, where is the list? Is there a list compiled of everyone who has either been released from a position for any reason or any disciplinary action other than those who are certified? So it became very evident from that conversation that that Department of Education had very strict regulations on those who are certified, but no regulation on those who are not certified. So then you start compiling the amount of people that is. That's a lot of individuals in our school district.
Another issue tied to the lack of a consolidated database is reporting of misconduct. Because Beerly held a state teaching certification, which he was issued in 2015, districts would have followed the same procedure for reporting full-time teacher misconduct. They would have had to notify DOE within 30 days of becoming aware of the situation. A DOE spokesperson has previously told reporters Beerly's misconduct was not reported to the state, a failure on the part of the school districts. But for substitute teachers who don't hold a certification, districts can handle discipline in-house without the requirement of notifying DOE. Striplin says that's a problem.
The first issue is, how can we form a database of everyone who comes in contact with our children, and if they have been released from any district, or better yet, any state? I mean, this needs to be nationwide, obviously.
There are also different requirements for full-time certified teachers and substitutes without a certification as it pertains to background checks. Florida statutes require school districts to establish their own protocol for hiring substitutes, but do require a complete set of fingerprints from prospective subs and a minimum education level of a high school diploma. The statute dealing with substitutes does not, however, require a specific level of background check. That's left up to the individual district, which DOE says most perform a level 2 background check, the same given to certified teachers. The red flags surrounding Beerly and his past behavior were numerous, including two separate Tallahassee arrests in 2012 and 2016 for grabbing women's buttocks. Beerly had a disturbing pattern of aggressive misogyny that went beyond criminal behavior, with some parents noting their unease at his social media activity. Many who came in contact with Beerly, school district administrators, as well as students, described his behavior as odd and off-putting. Democratic State Senator Bill Montford wants to prevent such patterns from going unchecked going forward.
We, as a state, we've got to make absolutely sure that whoever is around our young people, whether they're substitute teachers, teachers, volunteers, it really doesn't matter, athletic officials, all of them, we have to make absolutely sure that they're screened properly, and if there's a bad actor out there, we need to know who that is and make sure that we have a list of those on the state level.
Montford says he has plans in motion to begin talks with DOE on the matter.
What we need to do is find out exactly what the databases are out there now and make sure that they're ironclad and airtight. And we'll do that. I mean, we'll be working with the Department of Education to ensure that every adult that's around our children, whether they're volunteers or others, are screened and the backgrounds are checked.
Montford's term as a state senator ends in 2020, but he will maintain a key role in Florida education as CEO of the Florida Association of District School Superintendents. I'm Ryan Daly.
Still to come on Capitol Report, a rebuilding program is underway in several panhandle communities still struggling to recover from last year's Hurricane Michael, but many residents say that program doesn't have their best interests at heart.
I can barely pay the taxes I'm paying now.
And faced with hordes of invasive iguanas, Florida wildlife officials are urging residents to kill the critters humanely. And how exactly do you do that? The first anniversary of Hurricane Michael is now just a few months off, yet a distressing degree of distress remains. We have three stories, and we'll start in one of the communities that was very close to the storm's point of landfall. 10 months after Michael, communities in the Big Bend are still struggling to recover, but in the small city of Port St. Joe, big changes are coming. And not everyone is on board, as we hear from Robbie Gaffney.
Residents from opposite sides of a controversial development issue are packing into Port St. Joe's commission meeting. The city's Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard is currently zoned for mixed use, meaning property can be used for residences or businesses. In 2016, a small group of locals formed the North Port St. Joe Project Area Coalition, or PAC. They set out to define where the commercial district should end and the residential one should begin, and that's causing nearby homeowners to wonder if they will be displaced by the new boundaries.
Yes, my name is Sarah Williams, and I had no knowledge of nothing. Hadn't received no notice about rezoning. My home has been in this community well over 70 years. 70! What in the world I want to commercialize my own property for? I can barely pay the taxes I'm paying now.
The PAC has presented its plans to the city, and now the city is considering changes to the land use map. John Hendry is a consultant for the PAC. He says the new language will protect current residents rather than displace them.
What we did was to say, okay, the underlying use remains mixed use, but what we want to do is make sure that we're really clear about three zones. The first one is the commercial zone, which runs between avenues A and C.
Hendry continues.
We wanted to preserve the part of the street that was dedicated to residential occupation. So we made that a separate zone.
The third zone is transitional. It would link the commercial and residential districts, but tensions rose during the city commission meeting when residents like Linda Hill said they never received a notice of the possible land use change.
I feel like we should know something before anyone votes.
But the city's planning consultant, Ray Greer, says the city fulfilled its legal requirements.
They have notified all property owners of the future land use map amendment, including the ability to enact out of it.
Excuse me, let him speak, excuse me.
President of the PAC, Chester Davis, says despite the controversy, the new language is the first step to restoring the area.
We just had it going on in common words. Like I said, everything worked within its own self, like the grocery store was owned by local people that lived above the grocery store. The tavern and the bars had apartments above it. So everything there was, it's just lively. I mean, it was a good place to grow up.
During Davis's childhood, Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard was Main Street. It served as a bustling community center that had everything from grocery stores to a dentist's office. The nearby paper mill served as the main source of job security. It closed in the late 90s, and Davis says the economy never recovered.
The buildings has become unlivable. Most of them are torn down. The history that we have had is no longer visible. You can't see what we used to have at all.
The Jesse Ball DuPont Fund has been a main stakeholder for North Port St. Joe's development efforts ever since its founders died. The company financed a survey that identified the community as blighted. PAC consultant Hendry explains this further.
Low property values, low lot values, and just a sense that the neighborhood had been left behind.
Residents like Letha Matthews joined the PAC after buying property on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard.
So what we want to do on the lower floor is make businesses, four businesses, and then up on the two top floors, I think we're going to have two 2-bedrooms and one and two 1-bedroom apartments.
But Woodward Avenue resident Crystal McElroy says miscommunication among neighbors has divided not only Port St. Joe, but neighboring areas as well.
We've seen these issues over in our neighborhood, right? Woodward, Marvin, kind of turning us against each other as neighbors. You've seen it now here. You saw it over at Highland View.
Port St. Joe's city commissioners voted to adopt the new land use amendment. The city's next step is to review whether the PAC's rezoning plan is viable. I'm Robbie Gaffney.
But while communities like Port St. Joe are ambivalent about their version of storm recovery, there's far less controversy when it comes to some other storm casualties. After Michael ripped through the panhandle last year, it left much of the area battered and beaten, and one of the most impacted counties is Bay, and that's where Tyndall Air Force Base is located. The base suffered nearly $5 billion in damage, but officials at the base used the disaster as a chance to rebuild for the future. Their hope was that the Air Force would bring in F-35 fighter jets, and that plan has now paid off.
Officials at Tyndall Air Force Base started working toward recovery right away. Most of the early stages involved demolishing or repairing damaged buildings. Executive Director of the base's reconstruction program, Brigadier General Patrice Melanson, says there's still more to be done.
So we do have some demolition that still is ongoing and still needs to be done. But we've moved forward. We're partnering with the Corps of Engineers for the military construction work and have actually got design firms on board to start doing design work on those military construction projects.
In April, Brigadier General Melanson said they had spent nearly $300 million on demolition and repairs. They had run out of money and had to wait for supplemental funding. That eventually came in June in the form of a disaster relief bill, which included $1.67 million in funding for the Air Force. But not all of it was for Tyndall.
Unfortunately, Tyndall was not the only base affected by natural disasters. So we got about, I think it was $550 million, roughly is what we're going to get from the FY19 supplemental.
That $550 helps out, but Melanson says the project will definitely need more.
We've got, like I said, $2.8 billion worth of military construction that's identified.
One of the reasons for the high cost is that Tyndall isn't just rebuilding, but redesigning the layout of the base. Officials decided to go with a design that would work for the future. The hope was that in doing so, the Air Force would commit to bringing F-35 jets to the base. And this week, that happened. Tuesday, the Interim Secretary of the Air Force announced his commitment to bringing three F-35 jets to Tyndall by 2023.
Certainly having the F-35s there is going to enhance the overall training that's able to be done for the Air Force as a whole, not just for Tyndall.
Melanson says the news isn't only great for what the future holds, but also for the sake of the rebuild.
We will continue full speed down the path that we've been going down already. The good news is that we didn't have to go potentially rework some things if the decision had come out otherwise.
Meanwhile, Melanson says base officials are holding another industry day September 12th in an effort to secure the needed workers for the project and make sure the surrounding community is on board.
That particular industry day is going to focus on construction and construction logistics. As you can probably imagine, doing that much construction work in one area and also having construction work going on downtown, we're a little bit concerned about how we're going to be able to effectively find the labor force that we need to do all that construction and not compete and prevent downtown from being able to come back with their construction.
As for funding the rest of the project, Melanson says the base will have to wait until Congress and the Air Force decide how much Tyndall will get in fiscal year 2020. I'm Blaze Ganey.
Next up is a story that combines both storm aftermath and the impending start of school. First Lady Casey DeSantis has prioritized expanding access to mental health services to residents across the state. As part of her campaign called Hope for Healing, she announced this week that K-12 students in every public school across six Northwest Florida counties will have virtual access to mental health evaluations and counseling. Capitol reporter Valerie Crowder reports state leaders chose to focus on the region because of that increased need for services in the wake of Hurricane Michael.
About 60 telehealth portals will be ready for public school students in Gulf, Franklin, Jackson, Liberty, Gulf, and Bay counties when they return from summer break on Monday. At a press conference in Panama City yesterday, DeSantis told reporters several state agencies worked together to ensure the mental health devices were installed before the start of the school year.
This is not something that we're doing because we want to feel good about ourselves. We're doing this because we ultimately believe this is going to help save lives.
Through the portals, students can video chat with a mental health professional located anywhere in the state. Bay County's public schools received 38 devices. Superintendent Bill Husfeldt says he's hopeful students will feel comfortable receiving care using this technology.
Kids communicate distance-wise now, so we think there might be a layer of relaxation that comes because they're not necessarily in front of someone. And so we'll see how this works. If this works real well and we need to get more portals in, we'll do it. We'll get them in.
Husfeldt says this technology isn't new to the district. He says many of its elementary schools already have telehealth portals that connect students with primary care physicians.
We have health techs that get on with a doctor and can communicate back and forth and take the temperature, and the doctor can diagnose and prescribe a biotic or medicine if they're sick. This just takes it to the mental health level.
Husfeldt says housing-related challenges are taking a toll on many parents in the community, and children are also feeling that pressure, which increases the need for mental health treatment in school.
We had two elementary kids right before the end of the school year take a razor blade and try to slit their wrists on elementary playground. Elementary age kids don't just come up with ideas like that. They're hearing and seeing the tragedy and the frustration that's in their parents' lives and what's going on. And our goal is to try to get to those kids and say, look, what are you dealing with? How can we help you? And this is just one awesome tool we have to do that.
Big Bend Community-Based Care is the region's network management agency for child welfare, mental health, and substance abuse. CEO Mike Watkins says the devices will help reduce missed appointments and bring more providers into communities that need them.
We struggle to have enough children's mental health services in any community, whether it's rural or otherwise. But this will allow us to schedule virtually appointments, regardless of where the therapist is located, what city or town.
Watkins says his organization will oversee maintenance of the devices and scheduling with providers from across the state, but they'll primarily come from this region.
Our commitment is to try to have a local and regional approach. First of all, we want the jobs in North Florida. That's number one. And number two is if that child or family needs additional services beyond, you know, virtual technology, they're right here on the ground to try to get them into the next level of care.
Kaiser Family Foundation has identified 183 areas in the state where there are not enough mental health service providers to meet the community's needs. State Secretary of Healthcare Administration Mary Mayhew told reporters yesterday that the portals could help alleviate the burden that this places on people struggling with untreated mental illness.
This is going to be a pilot to understand what more can we do around the state. And so the opportunity to learn from and to benefit from this initiative here, this is going to change not only the lives of children and families in this area of the state, but it holds promise for so many throughout the state.
The telehealth portals cost $2 million, which came from funds for the Department of Children and Families. Therapists will bill students insurance for each virtual session. Students who lack insurance can also receive care through the devices. In addition to the telehealth portals, school districts and counties recovering from Hurricane Michael will get help with recovery from U.S. Department of Education inspectors who plan to open an office in Tallahassee soon. I'm Valerie Crowder in Panama City.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, when Florida wildlife leaders effectively declared open season on iguanas, they called for the animals to be killed on private property. And just this week, they doubled down on python eradication. Both animals are considered invasive species in Florida, but recent and past issues with how the animals have been killed have led to accusations of animal cruelty. The state says all killings have to be done humanely. But what does that actually mean? Lynn Hatter tried to find out.
In April, wildlife researchers in the Everglades landed a record, a 17-foot-long, 140-pound pregnant female python and her 73 eggs. Pythons have been causing chaos in South Florida for years now. Their long livers, prolific reproducers, and they're huge. They can eat almost anything, including mid-sized mammals, and they do. Several years ago, the state okayed the hunting and killing of pythons in the Everglades. Now, it's expanding those eradication efforts.
We're going to increase the pressure on a snake that is actually destroying all of our natural food chain in the beautiful Everglades.
Developer Ron Bergen is known as Alligator Ron. He's a conservationist and a member of the South Florida Water Management District. He recently joined Governor Ron DeSantis in announcing that the animals can now be killed at any state park where they're found. The snakes aren't the only animal on the state's hit list. In June, the Florida Wildlife Conservation Commission announced iguanas can now be killed on private property. And shortly after that, reports of people abusing the animals emerged, including this disturbing video showing people running over an iguana with a grocery cart and laughing.
Oh my God! Oh my God! R.I.P. Look, iguana, whatever your name.
FWC sent out updated directives condemning animal abuse, noting that it was investigating the video and stating that iguanas must be killed humanely. But it didn't say how that's done.
And that's one of our objections to these orders, because reptiles have a very unique physiology. They are very highly tolerant of conditions that result in lowered oxygen and blood pressure levels. So it's imperative when you kill a reptile that the brain is destroyed immediately. If it isn't, they can continue to sense pain for up to an hour.
Lori Kettler is with the animal rights organization PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Kettler acknowledges Florida has a big invasive species problem. She also acknowledges the need for removal, but she takes issue with the lack of instruction given with such kill orders. She says there's a definite wrong way to kill pythons and iguanas. There's also a right way.
The only non-conditional methods of euthanasia that are approved by the AVMA for reptiles, and especially with regard to large reptiles like pythons, is the use of a penetrating captive Bolt gun or gunshot to the brain. And even with those two methods, people have to be properly trained about placement.
The FWC has noted that people not trained to handle the animals should seek help from those that are. Still, Kettler and others would prefer no animals be killed. And she says the root of Florida's problem has to do with people. After all, iguanas and pythons did not bring themselves to the state's shores.
The wild populations are all the result of escapes or releases into the wild and the progeny of those animals. If they did a few years ago ban the private possession of pythons and the import and that kind of thing, then why haven't they done the same thing for iguanas?
The FWC says a ban on the reptile now would come too late because iguanas are already established in Florida. I'm Lynn Hatter.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Robbie Gaffney and Valerie Crowder. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.